This is an ABC podcast.
Rima Hachidi is my guest on Conversations today. Rima is one of the stars of the Cirque du Soleil show Curios, which is touring Australia at the moment. If you've seen the show, you definitely remember Rima. She struts around the stage in a gorgeous red velvet dress and fur stole, very, very glam, with giant eyelashes and 1920s hair. The other thing about Rima is that she's just 100 centimetres tall. She's one of the smallest adults in the world. She has a genetic condition, one that is so rare it's named after her, Rima syndrome. Hi, Rima.
Hello.
Tell me more about your role in the Cirque du Soleil show, Curious. What kind of character is it that you play?
Well, Mini Lily is a character that is basically the ringleader of the circus, and she is a very grand personality. She holds her own, very confident. She's very demanding. She's very regal. So she is kind of a character that is a juxtaposition of her physicality, and that's what makes her even more interesting.
How do you play with size in that character? What do you mean a juxtaposition? How does it work?
Well, it's like the eyes trick you because the emotion tells you something else, and because we've been trained to believe that small things are timid and quiet and shy or intimidated. So to see someone like that to be very grand and confident and owning the space then challenges you with the way that we typically see things.
How is it that you first appear to the audience? Tell me about that moment.
That's a surprise. You have to go and watch the show to see that.
Well, what kind of reaction? What do you hear in the audience when you suddenly pop out?
It's interesting because you hear gasps and you hear, sounds of delight and sound. It's quite lovely to see adults with the twinkle in their eyes, like little children, actually.
And what about kids? Do you hear kids in particular at moments when you're on stage?
Actually, children are much better than adults in the audience. They're just so quiet and mesmerised. It's usually the adults that get a little bit rowdy.
Kids are transfixed. So there's all these other acts that are happening around you, the kind of jaw-dropping stuff that Cirque du Soleil is famous for. Which of those acts is your favourite to watch? Which still drags you in to stare from the side of the stage, if you're allowed to?
One of my favourite acts is Roller Bowler, and it's this man that balances on something that up in the air and not allowed to fall, and that one always gets my heart pumping. After 4 years, it still gets me quite excited.
It's extraordinary.
Yeah, it is quite extraordinary.
Yeah, and then there are other acts which just seem to be about joyful exuberance. I think about all the acts on the trampoline. They're just so delightful to watch in the audience.
Absolutely, yeah. It's just the level of energy, and they're so good at what they do that they've perfected it, that make it just look effortless and beautiful.
As I mentioned, Rima, you wear this beautiful sort of 1920s velvet gown and fur stole. Do you enjoy that costume that you have to don each performance?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, Mini Lily has started to bleed inside my personal life.
What does that mean? That could be dangerous.
I'm just like, where's my martini? Come on. Yeah, it's just it's hard to switch off sometimes, and we live and breathe our art, and it becomes part of who I am. And even in how I do things from my personal life, there is a little bit of Mini Lily that comes in to my choices.
How do the rest of the people in your life feel about that?
Well, you have to ask them, really, but I don't know if they like it all the time, because I can be quite demanding. As such.
Were you one of those kids, Rima, who was always performing?
I was one of those kids that had a very wild imagination, and I was never bored, and I always had pretend friends and tea parties and collecting flowers from the garden and making my own perfume and just always very creative and, yeah.
Was there a lot of music in your family growing up?
Yes, my father is a musician and I grew up with a lot of different artists that were musicians as well, and so we always had creative people around us as well.
Your family, your parents originally came from Lebanon. Whereabouts did they move to in Australia? Where did you spend your childhood?
I spent my childhood in Adelaide predominantly, and then we moved very briefly to Lebanon, and then I came to Melbourne after that, and I grew up in Melbourne as a young teenager.
And what made your parents come out from Lebanon, do you know? What was the decision to settle in Australia about for them?
Look, Australia, I think, you know, they came at a very young age as well. They were young adults, and so Australia was a great place to have a different life and a different way of doing things. And I think my parents appreciated it immensely of what Australia provided for them.
And when you came along, Rima, did they know straight away when you were born that something was different?
I think it took a few months until they realised that there was something significantly different. And they did go on a little journey to figure out what that was, to see if there was a doctor around the world that had a better understanding. And unfortunately, they didn't find the answers they were particularly looking for.
So what doctors here in Australia didn't have any idea what was different?
Yeah, they were kind of taking a stab in the dark. And I think in my own experience, that's kind of what they tend to do. You just don't really know, you know?
And the main feature that your parents were concerned about was size. Was that the only issue that was different?
I think because it was so significantly, dramatically different, they also were very paranoid that there would be some additional medical problems that came with that. And I think, you know, my parents just wanted me to be healthy and happy, and they just, to not know, I think, was the scary part of it, and not know what the future holds and not know anything, and just take each day as it came.
Has your mum ever talked to you about that period where they didn't know what was happening and what that was like for her?
Yes. I mean, me and my mother actually have had a very deeper relationship, because now I'm a mother and I worry about my son in similar ways that my mother worried about me. And so I, you know, we have talked a lot deeply about that. And
where did your parents go to try and find answers if there wasn't any clarity here in Australia? Where did they go?
We went to Europe for a few months and went to different parts of Europe to see. But, yeah, there was a lot of different opinions, a lot of different hypotheses going on, but nothing definite.
And when then did doctors come up with the conclusion that what you must have, Rima, is Rima syndrome? When did that become a term that they used with your family?
It's because in the medical history that has, I mean, maybe in Papua New Guinea there's someone that has what I have, but there's no one registered that has what I have, other than me and my brother.
So that is rare, isn't it?
It is quite rare.
And what's caused that difference? Have doctors been able to say?
It's just a chromosome, and when two people are carriers of that chromosome, they can create. I mean, I'm the carrier, but I cannot give a person what I have. But yes.
So when your parents got together, it's not like they had a history in either family and thought, oh, this is a risk we're taking. It was a completely unknown thing for them as well.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah, wow. So, I mean, there must be such a challenge then in those early years for doctors to have any sense of being able to predict, oh, well, this is what's likely to happen. These are the kind of health issues or other concerns. It must have been, as you said, a stab in the dark.
Yes, it was. And I think, you know, doctors don't like not knowing. So they will keep poking and prodding until they know something. And that, for me, growing up, became a little bit agitating for myself, feeling like a scientific experiment. And so, you know, you just have to put some boundaries in place and go, no more, actually. I'm fine. I'm happy. Just leave me alone.
What kind of relationship do you have with doctors now? Like, have you found doctors that you've got a good trust with? Or
I'm a little bit on the cynical side, and I really do. And, I mean, bless their heart. They do have their heart in the right place and they do want to help. But I feel like if I was to always listen and be in that world, then I would not live my life fully. So I had to break away a little bit from that.
And as you say, you're not a medical experiment or a medical condition to yourself, you're you. When did you first have a sense that your size was different from other people's? I mean, what kind of age are you aware, okay, I'm different from the other kids around me?
At a very young age, actually. I do remember even, like, my father taking me to a group of people who were of short stature, and I felt very out of place there as well.
Why was that, do you
because
think?
Because they were differently short. So at a young age, I felt very alone and isolated in not knowing where I fitted in. And then I had an epiphany and I realised that you can fit in different ways with people. You don't have to, just because you're black, you don't have to hang out with black people. Just because you're short, you don't have to hang out, or fat or skinny. There's just physical elements that we can have similarities or unsimilarities with, but you can be the same in the way you think, in the way you see things in the world, in the way you feel. And so that is where I connect with people on that level, to make me feel like I'm part of something.
How old were you when your little brother was born?
I was 7.
And what do you remember about that expectation?
Well, apparently when I found out that my mother was pregnant with my brother, I went on my knees and I prayed for him to be small like me so that we could share that together. So he blames me for that.
You got some power. You got some influence upstairs.
That's right.
So that's what you wanted as a little kid. But for your mum and dad, I mean, how were they facing having another child with this same extraordinarily rare condition?
I think, you know, it was overwhelming and at times stressful for them. But I think it got a little bit easier because they knew what they were entering in based on the journey they had with me. So it was a little bit more relaxed.
You paved the way for him, I suppose.
I suppose. Yeah. Or they paved the way for themselves as well.
And were you two very close as kids?
We were, and we still are as adults. Yeah, he's not just my brother, he's like one of my closest friends.
When you were both still quite young, your parents decided to go back and live in Lebanon for a bit. What was that about, do you think? Why did they want to return there?
Just to stay connected to the roots of our nationality, and that just having that spiritual connection that you tend to have with your culture.
And what was it like for you arriving in Lebanon for the first time?
It was quite interesting because I grew up in Australia predominantly, and I grew up in a very Australian culture, surrounded by different cultures in Australia. So when I went to Lebanon, it was quite different in that way. It was more driven by religion and politics, and people with difference treated a little bit differently in Lebanon.
Tell me about that. I mean, did people respond differently to your size there than what you'd experienced in Australia?
Yes, they did, but not necessarily better or worse, just different. They didn't ask as many questions as what Australians would usually do. They are more accepting, but in that acceptance, they treat you differently.
So how did you feel about coming back to Australia? Did you have a preference at that age about where felt a better fit?
I do feel like in Australia, I was able to exercise my ability to reach my potential. I was in an environment where I could do that. If I was in Lebanon, I think there would be more fighting to have that. And less freedom to explore it.
And have you been back to Lebanon since that initial visit?
No, I haven't, unfortunately, but I do want to go back. I just haven't found the right time.
And which part of it draws you, Rima, if you think about it as a country? What element do you want to connect with again?
Oh, the sound of... I remember going into some of the villages and the sound of the donkey walking on the pathway, the smell of the herbs growing in the garden, and it's more the nature element and the smiles and hospitality that people had and the generosity that they exuberated every time you walked past them.
Back in Australia is where you went to high school in Melbourne, and that can be a tricky time for everyone. What was high school like for you?
Yeah, it wasn't the best time of my life. I remember teachers always saying, high school is the best time of your life.
Only teachers say that, honestly.
I know. And I just hated it. I just was like, I can't wait to get out into the big world and choose my people that I want to hang out with.
Hated it because of the contact you were having to be in with your classmates.
Well, I went to a private school, and so that, for me, they really pushed academic subjects more than artistic ones. And I was never an academic person, and I was made to feel like shit because of that. And so I had to fight and actually start accepting and embracing that I'm a creative person. I love art. I express myself in an artistic way, and that's who I am, and I shouldn't feel bad that I can't do the academical stuff. Yes.
Were there any teachers there who encouraged that performer side of you at high school?
I did. I had, as in my later period of high school, there was one teacher, and I feel really bad because I've forgotten her name, but she really gave me the space to start exploring myself in an artistic way and gave me the permission to do so, and that was really great. I was very grateful for that.
As well as your relationship with your school colleagues and your teachers, teenagers have these relationships with their parents. Were your parents protective of you in that period as you're going from child to woman?
Yes, especially my mother in particular, always frightened of the world, always feeling like something's going to happen, always, that fear. And we butted heads quite a bit, actually, because I had different values to that, and I was challenging her values. And I mean, I guess that's how you learn in life, is when you are challenged. And I think on hindsight, I look back and we both learnt a lot from that.
Teen years are that time where, you're also really coming to grips with your own physical self-image. How did you find the mettle to own your own self-image and to be who you are and to not do some comparison game that was not going to work for you?
Yeah, it was confronting, and it was a journey, and it was a hard one, actually. But it was one that I wouldn't change for the world, because when there's struggle in life, that's when you learn the most about what's actually important, and you only realize how important it is when it is a struggle. And I connect a lot, for example, with people who are homosexuals or transgender or transsexuals who have to fight to be that in society. And so I had that similar journey where I had to fight to be a sexual being in this society with the body that I have.
And did you have models or, you know, were there people that you thought I can follow? They've carved out a path, I can follow that. Was there anyone like you that you could look up to?
No. It was, you know, that as well is a thing where you actually have to look up to yourself and believe in yourself and know in your gut when something is right and when it's wrong and when it's worth fighting and when it's worth backing down. And that's something that I've had to learn from a very young age, but it's a lesson that I feel very privileged to have learnt.
Tell me how you started doing belly dancing then, Rima. How did that come into the picture?
So belly dancing comes from my background nationality. And whenever I watched belly dancers dancing, I realised that they were always very captivating and all eyes were on them and they had the control and the power. And that's something that really allured me and interested me, especially when, you know, in the culture, women in lots of scenarios didn't have the power. In this scenario, they did. And so that was something that I wanted to explore in myself. And so I did, and it did give me a sense of power and a sense of strength and quite liberating in a way, just to know within yourself the power you hold.
Did you have a teacher, or how did you go about becoming a dancer?
I just watched it a lot, and I tried to mimic the movements that they would have. And then I put my own little personality spin on it.
And what kind of costumes? Because costumes are a big part of belly dancing. What would you wear?
Yeah, so there was a lot of costumes that came back from Lebanon, because I'd say, can you please get me a belly dancing costume? And Mum would bring me one and Dad would bring me one. And then I would put extra sequins on it. And
extra sequins?
Yeah. Yeah, it's all about sequence.
And you were actually belly dancing for work.
I performed at the famous Spiegeltent. I performed with a show called La Clique for a little bit. I did a few tours with them, and I also travelled to Europe and did some just solo shows there, and yeah.
Did you find, you know, you were saying that with the role you play of Minnie Lily in Cirque du Soleil, it kind of bleeds into your everyday life. Did you find that taking on that character, the performer of the belly dancer, did that shift how you saw yourself even off stage?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think, you know, the great thing is when you take on a character or you take on an artistic form, it does interfere with your personality, or it also contributes to your personality, because we have the ability to be those things if we put more energy in those areas. And so sexuality at that time for me was important. So exuberating that kind of energy gave me, you know, manifested that energy back into my life.
So why, in all of this stuff that's happening for you in terms of being a performer in your 20s, why did you decide to take the plunge into reality TV?
Well, that's a good question. I am a very naive, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed kind of person, and I hoped that I could shine some light into difference, into the mainstream world. Unfortunately, I failed epically at that, and but that's okay, because that's what I'm learning with all that, is that I'm not anybody's teacher, and that was a very arrogant thing of me to assume that I had that.
Podcast, broadcast, and online. You're listening to Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. Hear more conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app or go to abc.net.au. rima.com.au/conversations.
Rima, you were saying you decided to enter the big bad world of reality TV in 2008. You went on Big Brother. What on earth was that experience like, just being locked in that house with cameras all of the time? I mean, what was it like?
It was unnatural and quite unpleasant, actually.
What was the most unpleasant part?
Just being surrounded with very unintelligent people.
People of average height, but above average stupidity.
Correct.
How did they respond to you?
As an with great unintelligence.
So did you ever think, I mean, were you in there thinking, I just want to get out of this? Or were you still think I can change people's minds?
You know.
Did people recognise you in the street?
Yes, they did.
How did that feel?
Very exposed. I don't like it, actually. It was very, you know, when you want to go and have a coffee with a friend, or you just want to hang out, or you're feeling really shit, and someone comes up to you and you're just like, oh, I don't want to have to be polite and talk to you. And, you know, it just felt really exposed.
That world of reality TV just seems to kind of keep growing like Topsy. When you see new participants going into any one of those shows, what goes through your head? What do you think?
It's so sensationalised. And I think, you know, society just is so obsessed with the glamour of being on screen, and, you know, it's so superficial and unreal, actually. But there's that drive that people want to have that 5 minute of fame. And it is, you know, it's gotten actually even worse with the social media that we have now, where I call it emotional prostitution, where they just share too much all the time.
I like that phrase. So you, though, after Big Brother, I think, got into burlesque, which for some people might think is a much more exposing or a much more vulnerable kind of space. What drew you into the world of burlesque?
It is vulnerable, but it's also like food for the soul. And it grounded me back to my authenticity of who I really am. And I am a person that is in her body. I am proud of my body. I like expressing myself through my body, and be surrounded by people who celebrate that because they share that journey as well.
What kind of bodies tend to get celebrated in burlesque?
Bodies that are quite curvaceous, bodies that have different genders and skin colour, so much variety. Oh, it's just beautiful.
was that a relief to be somewhere where variety was the thing that was in favour rather than a standardised averageness?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, it was like drinking red wine again instead of Coca-Cola.
I was wondering, though, like when you talk about going on stage or being on stage with burlesque, or I guess with belly dancing or with circus, is getting people to look at you on stage, is that a way of embracing the experience that you'd have every day on the street of being stared at? Is that, how is it that you can take control of being looked at, of being stared at? Is that part of what draws you to performance?
In a way, yes. Because when I'm walking down the street, I don't get to choose how people look at me, what forms of opinion they have of me, what experience I'm going to have with them. But when I'm on stage, I'm the one that dictates how I want to be looked at, what I want to be seen, and what material I choose to expose.
Did you always want to be a mum, Rima?
Yes, I've always wanted to be a mother.
And what did these doctors that you have consultations with, what did they think about that idea?
They thought it was a horrible idea.
For what? For you or for the baby or what was the concern?
The whole schkaboodle, really.
The people next door, the street, everyone.
Everybody. It's bad for everyone.
But did you have to have, you know, did you have to have fairly serious medical discussions about the risk that you must have been putting yourself through?
Absolutely. And I was told what risks they were and I didn't enter it with my eyes blind. I entered it with my eyes wide open and also naive and bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. And it was a very hard journey that I went through with my son, but it was worth every little pain, every little tear.
What was the process of pregnancy like? How did you feel being a pregnant woman?
Oh, the pregnancy side of it was amazing. It was so beautiful. He was contained. He was in one area. It was so romantic. Oh, just felt like a goddess with this beautiful being growing inside my belly. And then the hard work actually started when he came out.
Did you have a sense before your son was born about whether you were having a boy or a girl? Did you know?
Well, once they could tell what sex it was, I wanted to know because I knew that there was so many other surprises coming ahead. So let's eliminate one if we could. So they told me it was a boy and I only had a girl name and I was actually really taken back that I was going to have a boy, and on hindsight actually it doesn't really matter.
But
I was
had
so
a sense.
Yeah, I was so stuck, like, you know, I'm gonna have a daughter, and I had all these scenarios and what we're gonna do together and, you know, all this romantic play in my head. And yes, it was nothing like that.
Did you know before he was born whether he would have Reimer syndrome as well?
Yes, I knew that he wouldn't because it's that genetic side of things, it's impossible because I'm the carrier, but I cannot give it.
And so what kind of, in terms of all the risks you'd been told were there, was everyone healthy when he was born? How did it happen? I mean, did it happen in a way that felt good for you?
You know, it was hard in the way it happened. He was born premature, 24 weeks. He was in hospital for a year and a half. And it was a very difficult journey. And you know, my son still has some medical problems. You know what? I'm going to retract the word problems. I'm going to say challenges. And, but so what? So what?
Does he travel the world with you, Reimer?
He does. Yes, he does. And it's amazing that I can provide him with this type of environment where he's exposed to different ways of walks of life, different cultures. Yeah, it's incredible.
What does he think about you being on stage?
Well, my son has autism, so he's not very verbal. So the first time he saw me on stage and I popped out and I could hear him going, "Mommy!" And it was just so hard to try not to cry on stage in front of 3,000 people.
Was it a happy mummy or a concerned
mummy?
Mommy!
It was very dramatic. I'm like, you should be on stage here with me, my love. It was very Shakespearean. It was beautiful.
I've seen a gorgeous photo of the two of you together at Disneyland. What was that trip like?
Yeah, it was fantastic. It was so much fun. It was in Japan, in Tokyo, and he loves lights and all different sensory type things. So it was like a big party, actually. It was wonderful.
He must have, because he doesn't have Reimer syndrome, he must have surpassed you in height fairly early on.
Yeah, no, it's not hard to do, really. But yes, he's quite a tall boy.
Did that change the dynamic between you? How did it play out?
He knows that if he steps over the line, Mummy will kick his little bottom. But yeah, no, it's actually quite beautiful because now when we're together, he follows me around like a little shadow, and he turns on the lights for me when I ask him. He reaches things for me, and we talk about how I help him with things that he needs help with, and he helps me with things that I need help with. And so now it's become more of an exchange.
In terms of the logistic nature of life when you're 100 centimetres tall, what are some of the biggest challenges for you?
The biggest challenges is reaching things, actually, and having to think about, do I take my bag to the public toilet in case the lock is really high and I have to call my boyfriend to come and help me out? Or do I leave my bag here? So, you know, those little things.
So you're having to plan ahead.
Plan ahead a little bit, yes.
And because of your size, do you find that strangers that you encounter want to treat you like a child? Do you have to do that negotiation too?
Sometimes, but I mean, to be fair, it's, you know, they genuinely sometimes think that I am a child. So you have to give them the space to figure out that I'm not, and then react based on that behavior after figuring that out. You can't get too annoyed at the first initial, because it is hard to tell. I mean, you're not going to expect that you're going to see a petite woman.
What are the most annoying things that people say to you? What do you never want to hear again?
Never want to hear again. Why are you short? There's no real answer to that either.
How did circus become something that you wanted to enter? When did you start training for circus?
I started training after I had my son, and I...
because you hadn't had a big enough physical challenge.
Exactly, yeah. Well,
now trapeze.
Exactly. I just thought, why not? Let's just push the body to its maximum, you know. And I, actually, after having given birth to my son, I realized that my body is so capable of so much more than I ever gave it credit for. So the sky was the limit. Really?
What do you remember about the first few times you went up on trapeze?
Well, I'm scared of heights, and so I really wanted to just face my fears in every part of the sense. And so it was more for like a healing, because becoming a mother, there were so many things that I would become afraid of, and I just wanted to not feel so afraid. And so I just faced every fear that I can think of and dealt with it head on.
And did that work?
It did, yes.
When you began doing circus and you were training with Circus Oz, how did you hear, or how did Cirque du Soleil hear about you?
There was a man in Montreal who was an agent, and he had met my brother and he had heard of me. And so he contacted me and said, there's a role going. Do you want to audition for it? And I said, yeah, sure, why not?
And what was the audition? What did you have to do?
I just had to say some of the dialogue. Yeah, just like an audition, and videotape it and send it
because
to them.
Because traditionally, circus has not been necessarily a kind place to people of short stature. Did you have some hesitation about entering the world of circus because of that?
Yes, yes. And that's why I haven't really dabbled into circus until after having my son, where I thought I wanted to just expand my horizon. But that was always in the back of my mind. But when I got approached with Cirque du Soleil, obviously they have a reputation of prestige in the way they do things. So I was open for suggestion.
There is such a range of skills that are on show in a Cirque du Soleil performance. Is there some element, though, that you think you all have in common, the performers who make it into that world?
We're all very passionate in what we do and very dedicated.
What's it like in the hours in the lead up to a performance? What's the atmosphere like back tent?
Everyone just, you know, has their corner where they have to train and rehearse, and they're just in their zone, and we have to all respect each other's space in that zone.
So it's quite quiet backstage. It's not a frenzy.
It can be quite quiet, yes, because everyone has a different talent. So they all require to do different things, respecting people's space to do that.
What's the process for you getting ready for your character?
I have to put a lot of makeup and hair and so I listen to a lot of music while I'm getting ready to pump myself up, sometimes a bit of Beyonce, sometimes a bit of Missy Elliott, and then sometimes a bit of, what's her name, that French 1920s singer?
Edith Piaf?
Edith Piaf, yes. So, a bit of lots of music.
You get a bit of Gordes on tap,
yes,
and then
you're right to go.
The show must be so tightly choreographed. I mean, just to make sure that everyone lands safely. Does it still feel different on different nights for you as a performer?
Yes, it does sometimes. I mean, there's your personal life that is going on, and then you go to work. And you can't help but let a bit of your personal life bleed into your work, considering how much time we spend together. So I've found a way where if I'm feeling a certain way, I would ask myself, how would Minnie Lily behave if this is what she was going through? And then I would put that on stage, which will give that journey on stage a bit of a difference of an experience.
What kind of reactions does Minnie Lily have to certain things? How much you respond to a day where you're feeling cranky or annoyed at somebody?
Yeah, she can get quite cranky, I think, being a prima donna and all.
There's a lot of license there to be imperious.
That's right.
And life on the road, I mean, what's an average day like for you? What's your kind of schedule on a performance day?
Lots of coffee and rehearsing, meetings, preparation.
And what kind of bonds develop between you? I mean, there must be such a range of nationalities and languages. What connections do you have with one another as a crew and as performers?
Oh, there's all different types of connections. I mean, you cannot be close friends with everybody based on the fact that we're not all the same and we have different interests. But we do have like a respect and connection with each other from a broader sense with nearly everybody, because we all have to work together. And so you do hold the person you work with a little bit on a pedestal, because when it comes to the crunch, they're going to be there for you.
Where were you performing with Curios before this stint in Australia?
I actually took some time off when I had Osiris, my son, for about 6-7 years, and I laid low like broccoli for a little while.
And you did some time in Japan, though, with this show.
Yes, yes.
And what was the difference performing there than to the audiences here in Australia?
Well, Japanese people are very polite and very quiet. So there was no rowdy audience clapping enthusiastically and chanting random things. They were very polite in their clapping, very quiet. And so it took a little bit of adjustment, because we thought, oh, they're not enjoying the show, but they were enjoying it a lot, but they're just communicating it very differently. And I love that. And so you have to get that feedback in a different way and reprogram your mind.
What's it like for you performing back on home ground, and you're going to be performing in Melbourne, the city that has been your hometown? What's that feel like?
Yeah, look, when I first came, I actually was quite nervous to perform in Australia because of the reality TV shows, and my journey as a petite Australian was something that left a little bit of residue in my mouth.
A bit of a bad taste.
Not only bad, but just cautious, you know, just felt a little bit cautious. But coming here, yeah, I was quite nervous, but then they loved it and they enjoyed it, and it was nice to be coming with ammunition in a way, with some really top-notch artists from all around the world.
It's quite a squad
you've
got with you, Rima.
Absolutely. I got a good posse over there.
What do your parents think about the life that you've made for yourself?
My parents are very proud of me, actually. They're proud of both me and my brother. I think it was really hard for my mother to have such an eccentric daughter, but she has dealt with it with such grace. And, she only feels love and pride.
Will she come along and see the show?
She's watched it a few times already. Yes.
And this, the only other person you know of who shares your particular genetic condition, your brother, what kind of relationship do the two of you have now as adults?
Yeah, we have a really beautiful relationship. It's really great because when we're together, we can just relax, cook a nice meal and just chin wag about all the things and not have to perform anymore. We can just sit and be quiet with each other, which we love to do because we're so out there. So it's nice to chill with one another. To just chill, yeah.
Rima, it's been really wonderful to meet you. Thank you so much for sharing your story on Conversations.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.